Hello and welcome to the very first interview of season number 3 of The Measuring Post. And with me today, I've got a phenomenal guest who's got a very exquisite and long history. Crazy things this man has accomplished in his life. And I'm going to let him explain a little bit about what he's about now and where he's been to get to this point in his journey. But again, my name is Joe Massa. This is The Measuring Post, a place where we can learn and grow together. And with me today is the very prestigious and esteemed Mr. John Graham. Now, John is former military member. He's a climber, adventurer, a diplomat, an author, an activist, a public speaker, and now currently is the executive director of the Giraffe Heroes Project. So I'll let him explain what that is. But for now, John, welcome to The Measuring Post. How are you today, sir?
I'm happy to be here, Joe, and I'm fine. A cup of coffee really starts my day. I'm out here on the West Coast. Great.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely understand. I never quite got into coffee. It was never my thing. I don't need a whole lot of caffeine, but my wife definitely likes coffee. So enjoy your cup of Joe while you're talking to Joe. So tell us a little bit about currently what you're working on, or what is the Giraffe Hero Project, and what led you from point A to point B to get to where you are with this amazing company?
Oh, wow. What a story that is. Okay, the Giraffe Heroes Project is not about animals. I'm sure your listeners have already picked that up. It's about inspiring people, motivating people to stick their necks out. That's where the metaphor comes from. Giraffe has a long neck. We've been doing it for 43 years. The idea is really simple. I mean, it's been around for 100,000 years. If you want people in your culture to be heroic, well, you don't preach at them to be heroic. You tell them stories of heroes. Models, role models, examples. And that's what we've been doing. We find people and their men and their women, every color in the rainbow of from 150 countries. Some of them are kids, most of them are adults. And we tell their stories. And in hearing and reading these stories, other people say, hey, why am I sitting on my couch when there's a problem to be solved, when I can be a hero myself? I'm going to go out and do something. So that's basically our purpose for doing this. And in 43 years, of course, we've done a lot of other stuff, too. We've developed a curriculum for kids all the way from kindergarten to 12th grade, helping kids build lives of courage and compassion, helping lives of service. I've written five books, all on the themes of leadership, courage, and service. We keep going. I mean, I'm 83 years old. I have no reason to quit. I want to also say, because I want to get this in there, or I'll get in trouble tonight. The Giraffe Heroes Project was started by my wife, not by me. I'm not smart enough. And she was a young single mother in New York City in the early 1980s. And she saw that the news media were all gloom and doom when nobody was telling the stories of good stuff happening in New York or elsewhere, and no stories of heroes. It was all rather depressing. So Ann Medlock started the Giraffe Heroes Project as an antidote to the gloom and doom news of the day, and of today's day for that matter. And she started finding people sticking their necks out, and she started telling their stories. And in 1982-83, that was fight fax machines and printed press releases, and it was before the internet. And then she finally got into vinyl records. Remember those? Went round and round on a turntable, Joe? You're old enough to remember.
Oh,
yeah. She would do 3 minutes segments on vinyl records, send them out to radio stations to play. And that's how it all started. I thought it was not the way to go, because I was at that moment just leaving a pretty good career in the U.S. Foreign Service. And I thought that if I just got out there and started giving speeches, this is in the middle of the Cold War, that I would save the planet because I was such a great speaker. Very few people came to my speeches, but people were flocking to listen to Ann's broadcasts and read her press releases. So I finally got it. And the fact that I fell madly in love with her and married her made everything seem that she was doing more serious. But the real fact of the matter is that I really got educated by Ann of the power of storytelling. There's no more powerful motivation than telling stories. And like I said, people have known that since Neanderthals. And Ann was the storyteller of our day, the troubadour of our day, and she had figured it out. So we started working together about 1984. So we've been doing it ever since. And I urge people to go to giraffe.org, G-R-A-F-F-E. It's amazing how many people can't spell giraffe. There you'll find out what we're doing. And also, we've, over 43 years, we have told the stories of over 2,000 people, and their stories are all loaded into a library, which is accessible at giraffe.org. And I urge people to start scrolling through it and to be inspired by the stories of the giraffe heroes that we tell. And so that's the major part of my life. I still do things like that. I still do podcasts like yours. I have my own TikTok channel and YouTube channel called Badass Granddad. I'm really loving that show. I do 3-minute segments, mostly for the younger set, people half my age or younger. And I tell adventure stories, but then I lead into some kind of life lesson on courage or finding meaning or whatever. Getting great responses. I'm loving doing this. That's Badass Granddad. You know, I'm just doing everything I can. I see no reason to slow down, and neither does Anne. So here we are.
Yeah, and John, I got to say, just from learning about your story, you are a badass granddad. Now, not only did you have some, you know, thank you for your service, by the way, in the military, but you were the first person to climb the North Wall of Denali. You were this wild man adventurer that traveled the world. You've seen and done things that people only read about in biographies that I hope someday you write your own, because your story is truly inspiring. So take me back a little bit, way before the Giraffe Heroes Project, sort of, you know, where did your origin story come from, and what led you to find this great project, and what sort of changed your lifestyle from being this man of adventure to now the man of giving back and teaching?
Oh, well, here we go.
Oh, by the way, you mentioned biography. I'm going to forget if I don't do it right now. I did. I've done what you said. My memoir is called Quest, Q-U-E-S-T, subtitle Risk, Adventure, and the Search for Meaning. And you can get it from, you know, Amazon or your bookstore or whatever. So that's done. I've done that. And it's a pretty damn good book. Okay. Answer your question. The bumper sticker of my life is that I'm lucky to be alive. I have led a very adventuresome life, and it's funny because I didn't start in any kind of incubation for that, because I grew up in a mild-mannered American city, Tacoma, Washington, in a mild-mannered community and a mild-mannered family. No one in my life or my family had ever taken significant risk. I was expected that I would graduate from high school and go on to the University of Washington, come back to Tacoma and lead a nice life and raise a family as what, a lawyer or a doctor or something. And that's where I was headed. But then, and I won't go into all the details, I ended up just 17 years old getting a job on a freighter heading to the Far East. Now, in those years, this is late 50s, there were no container ships, and freighters were big ships that loaded themselves full of every stuff one trades in around the planet. And they were run by 50 or 60 really tough guys, big tough guys, because it was hard work. And anyway, I got a job on a freighter going to the Far East. And right away, these 50 or 60 guys took one look at me, and they said, "Oh, man, that kid. We're going to teach him some life lessons he'll never get in school." And I guarantee you, I won't go into detail because this is a family station, but they did. They succeeded in teaching me life lessons in that 2 months abroad in the Far East. The very first night, or maybe it was the second on that ship, I learned something incredibly important. I was out on deck, and another crewman approached me and began making sexual advances. And another crewman grabbed this guy, shoved him up against the bulkhead, beat the shit out of him, and all the while cuffing. Oh, magnificent cussing. I mean, I come from Tacoma, Washington. I never heard cussing like that, nor had I seen violence like that. And I thought I was utterly enchanted by it, because I had grown up as a tall, skinny kid, constantly bullied by other kids, and I was fed up with it. I wanted a real model of how to fight back. But unfortunately, my father, I loved the man, but he was a very soft guy. He got pushed around everywhere he went, losing jobs, whatever, contracts, because he was just too really soft. So he was not the model I wanted, and I was desperate to find a model because I was so tired of being pushed around by bullies. And here I am on now this ship, and I watched this crewman, his name was Roy, he's a big black guy, maybe weighed 250 pounds, shove this other guy around. And that's it. That's the model I want. And I remember going back to my cabin that night in front of the mirror, practicing cussing like Roy and pressing an imaginary foe up against the wall and beating the shit out of him. Wow. And the rest of that summer, I mean, there was a barroom brawl. There was all kinds of stuff that just, like they said, I grew up real fast. And the thing was, though, that I discovered on that trip, that there was a huge wide world beyond Tacoma, Washington. It was colorful and it was exciting and it was adventurous and part of it was violent and I just loved it. And I came back and totally changed. I mean, my life was like, oh, I want to be like Roy. I want to be a man like that. And so my life got oriented toward becoming a Roy or a John Wayne, if you will, those movies of the day. And the next summer, two summers later, I was hitchhiking in Europe, and I saw that there was a war going on in Algeria, a colonial war between rebels who wanted to take the country away from the French colonials. And so I said to myself, well, now, I've never been in a war before. So I hitchhiked down through Morocco, stepped across the border into Algeria, no border guards, because after all, there was a war going on. And I was smart enough to put an American flag on my chest so that the rebels wouldn't take me for a Frenchman and shoot me. And I shouldn't have worried. The rebels were really friendly. They even stopped cars going in my direction at gunpoint and told people to take me where I wanted to go. So, you know, that was a hell of an adventure. There are a lot of stories from that hitchhike across to Algeria, staying with the French Foreign Legion, being constantly ahead of firefights and whatever. But I survived that. I came back. And the next year, with a bunch of my buddies from the university, I was with that group, and you mentioned this, that made the first direct descent of the north wall of then Mount McKinley. And it was a climb so difficult and so dangerous that no one's done it since. Anyone who's tried has been killed. It was an insanely dangerous climb. And that face on Mount McKinley is the highest mountain face on the planet, higher and steeper than anything on Mount Everest. It took us 38 days, and every day could have been our life. But we kept surviving avalanches and rock falls and crevasses and all the rest of it. And we made it, and we made it. We became the first ones, and that climb is now totally famous in annals of North American mountaineering. Now I came back from that. Now all I cared about was adventures. I graduated college, and I hitchhiked around the world. I had a contract with the Boston Globe to write stories on every war I came across. So I did that, and I immersed myself into the wars in Cyprus, Laos, and the beginnings of the war in Vietnam. I walked away from all of it without a scratch, which is important because I took all these adventures, and some of them were damn dangerous, but I walked away with all of them without a scratch. So that led me to believe that I was invulnerable. Now, every 20-year-old thinks he or she is invulnerable, but for me, it became like a religion. So I did really stupid things and took insane risks in terms of getting my stories for the Boston Globe. And anyway, I ended up on Australia where I was supposed to be going to graduate school, but I ended up spending more time drinking beer and chasing girls. And I also realized, though, that I had to earn a living. I wasn't independently wealthy. And now, as you've learned, the only thing that mattered in my life was the adrenaline rush. And so I said to myself, how can I keep these adventures going and earn money? Well, the answer was I was going to join the U.S. Foreign Service. I know you've said several times you're thanking me for my military service, but I never wore a uniform. I was in that part of wars and revolutions that didn't wear uniforms. And you can guess some of the stuff I was involved in, intelligence and counterintelligence operations, whatever, some of it damn dangerous. And for example, the second post I had was in Libya, and I was there when Muammar Gaddafi took control of the country in Libya, and I was in the middle of the revolution there, and I just loved it. Everybody else at the embassy in Tripoli was freaking out, but the instant I started seeing cars burning in the public squares and mob and rock throwing mobs, I was in my element. I just loved it. Because I realized I'd made the right choice. The Foreign Service was providing all the adventures and paying me for it. And I was surviving because I was then indestructible. So I just kept upping the ante. And all of my heroes were, like I say, people like John Wayne or the French Foreign Legionnaires in Algeria, or Roy, the guy on that initial ship trip to the Pacific. And that's what I wanted to be in. So I asked the State Department to send me to the most dangerous post it had, and they did. They sent me as a so-called advisor to the city of Hue, which was then in the very northern part of, that was then South Vietnam, just 50 miles south of the DMZ, the line that then separated North and South Vietnam. This is 1972. American troops were being withdrawn. Just a few civilians were left, including me. And I was there for a year and a half, and every day I was a target for assassination by the Viet Cong. And mind you, I didn't believe in the war. I thought the war was wrong. I thought the war was stupid. I thought the war was evil. I thought nothing good about the war in Vietnam. Only reason I was there was that I hadn't been in a shooting war before. I mean, the episode in Algeria, they weren't trying to kill me. But this time, there are lots of people out there gunning for me. And so I was there for a year and a half, because that was something I had not experienced before, right in the middle of the war. And here comes the big change, which is beginning to get to an answer to your question. I was then in my mid to late 20s. I wasn't a kid anymore. And not only that, but the risks I was taking weren't just impinging on my own life, like mountain climbing. What I was doing was making life or death decisions for a whole lot of other people up there in the DMZ. And so I was in the middle of a battle called the Easter Offensive, when the North Vietnamese Army tried to run over Vietnam and failed, but they came back 3 years later and succeeded. But anyway, in 1972, the North Vietnamese Army, the NVA, came storming across that border, heading straight for Hue, where I was. And the South Vietnamese Army, which is led by corrupt hacks, quickly folded like a paper tiger, and most of it fell back on Hue or just deserted. And so the NVA came within 10 miles, then 6 miles of Hue. And there was no more American Marines this time to defend it. There were just four of us civilians in the city, with the NVA closing in. And if they closed in, I couldn't get out, because if the Americans tried to send a helicopter to rescue me, the Vietnamese would swarm the helicopter and have to shoot them off the skids to get on. So my whole life depended upon somehow Hue surviving that onslaught. And in the middle of this, I looked at where I was. And I was responsible for the city of Hue, because the mayor, a chicken, had fled. And basically, the three of us American civilians were trying to patch together a civil, a martial law government, because we had to keep getting ammunition trucks through the city for the few troops still fighting to defend it 6-10 miles away. And I couldn't do it because the city was in total chaos. Because of deserters from the South Vietnamese Army, mostly kids dragooned off their paddies just a week or so before. So I remember going to the deputy mayor's office. He at least was brave enough not to run like the rest of his buddies. And I slammed my fist down on his desk and demanded he set up a firing squad to start shooting the deserters, even though I knew they were farm boys dragooned off their paddies. And they were scared shitless, and they had gotten drunk or high on drugs, and they were raping and looting, and they were the problem for the chaos in the city, and they'd burn the marketplace. And I sat there watching this pall of smoke from the burning marketplace and the thump of artillery. And it was like the end of the world. It was incredible. And so happened that the next morning, however, the clouds,
Well, it appears we have lost John, so we're going to see if he hops back on. This does happen when you're recording remotely, but as you could tell, John has had quite the adventurous life. He's the kind of man that really could write 10 or 15 novels just explaining the crazy adventures he's been on. I had the privilege of having a pre-interview conversation with John, and these are new stories to me. I've not heard some of these, but he had a whole list of other stories that we talked about that were equally as impressive and wild. I mean, he's lived like 45 lifetimes in his 83 years, and I really hope he can hop back on, because John is truly doing amazing work also. While I have you to myself for the moment until he does hop back on, the Giraffe Heroes Project is really, really awesome. I love the meaning behind it. And again, giraffes with their long neck, the whole point of the Giraffe Heroes Project is to stick your neck out for others, which I think is really something that people need to be better at. We're really good at taking care of ourselves. We're really good at looking out for number one. But when you put your mentality and your effort into sticking your neck out for somebody else, you really get to see what you're made of, and you get to find out the philanthropy and the ability to give back to your fellow man and woman is truly a remarkable experience that not many people get to say they've done. So again, if you're interested in learning more about them, you go to giraffe.org. That is giraffe.org. So giraffe.org. So again, he's right. Spelling the word giraffe is exceptionally hard for some reason. So he's a fantastic guy, and we're going to give him a few moments. Hopefully he hops back on here, and from there we'll continue our great conversation with John.
Am I back on?
You are back on. We got you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, there I was in the middle of this battle, and I was setting up a firing squad to shoot these kids, and I didn't know if it was a good idea or not. But suddenly you realize that I didn't give a shit about the war, as I thought it was evil and wrong and stupid. Here I was costing young lads their lives. And why was I doing that? I didn't believe in the war. I only believed in myself. I only believed in my own adrenaline rush. That's why I was in Vietnam, just for the adventure. And now people were dying because of that. I suddenly realized how shallow my life had become. And this is the key point. I mean, you asked for turning points. Here I was in the middle of this battle, having just ordered the firing squad to start shooting farm boys because they had deserted. I realized that my home was 8,000 miles away. I didn't believe in the war. And yet here I was, and the only thing that mattered to me was me. My life had become entirely selfish, and it all just descended upon me in the middle of this battle. And I think I even put my head down and whooped. I mean, I just finally realized how shallow my life would be. And it was the lowest point of my life. Well, it turned out that the very next morning, the skies cleared and fighter jets from carriers off the coast busted the hell out of the North Vietnamese troops attacking the city, and the tide was turned and my life was spared. Came back, though, to California, totally broken up, not just by what we would now call PTSD, but by the revelation that I was leading an incredibly shallow life and I had to do better. I had to find my soul. It was kind of like I realized I put a piece of plywood over my heart. I mean, I went to encounter groups in California. I really learned from other people that I really was a caring and compassionate person, but I couldn't feel it because of this plywood over my heart. I was convinced I was John Wayne and nothing else mattered, and emotions were what women did. And I realized how wrong that was, but climbing out of that hole wasn't easy. It took me a long time to develop a life based on service, coming full circle from a life based on adrenaline rushes. So anyway, the State Department, thank God, sent me to a place where I could do that. I went to the United Nations. And I quickly learned that I could do a lot to help on peace and justice issues in the third world, because I was in charge of America's operations, diplomatic operations in most of Africa. And there were a lot of pain out there and a lot of suffering and a lot of problems to be fixed. And I said, I was then totally turned around then. I become a total idealist in terms of peace and justice issues. In other words, the other side of who I've been for the whole first part of my life. And I worked hard at it. I'm really proud to say that, for example, one of the things I did was help end apartheid in South Africa, the system of institutionalized racism there. So, yeah, become a real engine for good, but it took me years after that battle in Vietnam and that horrible revelation of how empty my life had become. So I'm there at the United Nations, and I realized that I couldn't stay working for the State Department because, first of all, I was moving a lot faster than they were, and second, a whole lot of the State Department was part of the problem, not part of the answer. I couldn't stay working for them anymore. So I quit. And I found I could change the world through making wonderful speeches. And this brings us up to where I met Ann Medlock and the Giraffe Heroes Project. And so I realized I had to do something. I had to find a way to express the idealism that was now driving my But still, I was broke then. I'd used up all the pay the State Department had given me, and I was broke. And a friend says, well, hell, you can make money. You're really good on your feet lecturing. You can get, you can lecture on cruise ships. They actually pay you to go on cruises. I said, fine. And long story short, I got a job on a cruise ship heading from Vancouver to the Far East. Got to take my then 13-year-old daughter with me. All I had to do was give a couple lectures on U.S. foreign policy or whatever, and they paid me incredibly well. I got a free cruise. My daughter got a free cruise. But 2 days, 3 days off out of Vancouver, that damn ship catches fire and starts to sink in the North Pacific just as a typhoon is coming up. And there's a long story here, well told in that memoir I mentioned. But the long and short of it was that we had to abandon ship in the middle of the North Pacific, 140 miles off the Alaska coast. And I found myself and my daughter in a lifeboat. And it was really tough to rescue us 140 miles from shore. But helicopters came, U.S. Coast Guard, Canadian Coast Guard came. And they would lift people out of the lifeboats and take them to an oil tanker that had come into view answering the SOS. And so I watched Mallory get rescued about noon. We've been in the lifeboat since the night. About noon, Mallory gets rescued. But now the storm, that typhoon, is hitting us full force, and the helicopters can't fly anymore because it's too damn dangerous. And the possibility of me and the other, I think it was eight men left in that lifeboat, the only possibility of being rescued was with a Coast Guard cutter, small ship, was frantically searching the storm, trying to find us. And it was like needle in a haystack, because now the visibility was down to maybe 100 meters. And the storm was building. It got as high as a 60-knot winds with seas 25 to 30 feet. Now, that's like seas going up like a five-story building, up and down. You're a little cockle shell of a lifeboat. And we're all dying of hypothermia, and we're all incredibly seasick. There's no lights and no flares. And we have no warm clothes, and we're all dying. And I knew from my mountain climbing that we were going to be dead from hypothermia, dying of the cold in a few hours. So it's like, oh, man, all my adventures. This time I'm really going to cash in. I'm not going to make it. This time I'm going to finally die. So I said, I didn't say. I looked up into the sky, not being a religious person, but what the hell do you do when you realize you're in a situation like that? This typhoon is blasting you, you're freezing to death, and the cockleshell of a lifeboat's going up and down in these huge seas. So I tried to pray, my prayer, if that's what it was, turned into an angry bleat, and I began cussing out God, because damn it, I said, changed my life. Yeah, I know. The first part of my life was all about adrenaline, but the United Nations, I did some damn fine things that made life better for a lot. People. I mean, I helped end apartheid. Doesn't that count for something? Why are you wiping me out now? It makes it stupid, God, for you to wipe me out now that I've become an engine for what you wanted to do, which is, you know, help people. Well, I heard something back. I don't know if it was the wind. The other seven guys certainly didn't hear anything, but I heard a voice come out of that storm, and it basically said, stop kidding yourself. You're lecturing on a cruise ship. You get out of this, you'll lecture on another cruise ship. Those wonderful ideals you discover, well, they're not very strong, are they? You're lecturing on a cruise ship. And if you get out of this, you'll lecture on another one. And so you got to get serious about your life. What's driving your life? What's driving your life is helping other people, is being of service. And you're not doing that. So you might as well die out here, or the next 50 years of your life aren't going to be worth nothing. So I heard all this. And whether it was God or the wind, it doesn't make any difference. I heard it. And I looked into that storm, and I just says, okay, it's a deal. I'll follow that. I'll do that. I won't back out again. And that is,
you know, John, I really love that portion of your story. So I want to stop you for a second, because I did grow up religious, and I believe that prayer is powerful. And regardless whether that was something you found in your life before that moment, or whether that was the spark that changed your behavior or your lifestyle, what I really like about the morality of that portion of the story is how you talk about how the first portion of your life you felt very selfish. You were doing these things for the adrenaline rush, the endorphin flow, but you realized that there was more to life and that you could give more, and that your particular skill set would allow you to be a very powerful platform for good things in the world. And I like that, you know, of course, everybody has that moment that I would imagine. I've never been in a near death, you know, fatal crash on the ocean like that. But, you know, when you truly are up against the wall, the first thing most people are going to do is hands together, pray to, you know, the God you believe in, and, you know, look for the answers or the final moment of forgive me for what I've done sort of moment of clarity. But I have a question from that, and obviously you've gone on and clearly survived the boat sinking, and you've put in many years of great service, not only with your speeches, your stories, your books, your coaching guides, but now your work with the Giraffe Heroes Project. Do you think that brought you any sort of closeness to God is the first question. And then second of all, outside of that, once you got back onto land and obviously took a moment to really process what you had been through, was that like day one of a new life for you, even though you were sort of really mentally already pre-planning it? Was that truly like day one for you?
Yeah, it was. Also, I want to get in the punchline of that story, Joe. I looked at that voice from the typhoon, and I said, yes. And in that instant, the Coast Guard cutter Boutwell comes crashing through the storm with the boat heading right for our lifeboat. And that's how I got rescued. It was like instantaneous. Now, was it God? Was it? I mean, who knows? Oh, to get to your question, obviously, I came back to New York. I met Ann Medlock at the Giraffe Heroes Project, and the rest is the history we talked about as we began the broadcast. Did I believe more in God afterward? No, I didn't. And this is really weird. I mean, my life has been so weird. Somewhere in that process in the Giraffe Project, I got into spiritualism. That is to say, talking, I thought, directly to God through mystic trances. And I did that. And I spent a lot of time. So you're going to lose some listeners, but man, it's the truth. I spent a lot of time out of my body in trance states. I did trance healings, for example. I thought I was going crazy because, you know, I graduated from Harvard and Stanford. I was a mind person, and all this stuff about trances and stuff and mysticism was all bullshit as far as I was concerned. But there I was, and there was no other explanation. But I demanded to know. I mean, I wanted to know what the hell was happening. So I turned back to God, which by then I realized, in my view, was speaking to me, not from a robe in heaven, but just as some kind of force out there, some sort of unifying force, some sort of first cause. And I I looked for an answer, and I got it. I mean, as soon as I thought I was going crazy, I got the answer I needed as to whether I was going crazy or not. My then wife and I went down to a farm near Charlottesville in Virginia, owned by the parents of some Foreign Service friends of ours. And we were, it was a lovely place. It was a summer day. And the kids were playing out in the fields. And then all of a sudden, this passel of kids came running toward the porch where we were having a drink, yelling and screaming, because when a little boy, maybe 7, 8 years old, had put his hand on a red-hot tractor tailpipe and burned it horribly. And so all these kids rushed up to the adults on the porch, and the mother grabbed the kid, and the father went crazy trying to get there was no emergency services or to get a first aid kit or something. So I just felt something, and I asked the mother to give this screaming, burned child to me. And she looked at me, and she did, and she gave me this child, and I put his little burned hand between my hands like that, and I just put myself in that place of light and peace that I had been encountering in this 3 years of mystical states I was going through. And I put my hands away, and that kid's hand was not burned. It was totally healed. But how do you explain that? I mean, it was a sign. It was a sign I needed that what I called God, probably a little different from what you call God, but it doesn't make any difference. God, whatever, this force, was with me. And I needed to respect that. And I wasn't going crazy. So, you know, that's an explanation. And so I got to say, Joe, that, yeah, I totally believe in God. I totally believe in the divine, unifying, first cause force. But I don't necessarily believe in a Christian God or a Muslim God or a Buddhist God. It's more universal than that for me, although I have utmost respect for friends of mine who follow the Christian faith, the Jewish faith, or whatever. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's motivated by
love. No, it is. That's a great answer. And, you know, I grew up as a Catholic. There's a lot of denominations of Christianity and obviously Judaism, you know, Buddhism, Muslim, or Islam. So, you know, we don't have all the right answers always, and we'll never know until you make that final ascent to heaven or nirvana or whatever you'd like to call it. But I love that there is a divine interconnection, a spirituality layer to it. And that is enough for an answer for me. I definitely, agree. And it is amazing. You know, you talk about losing an audience from talking about the trans healing and sort of like this transcendent vision and experience. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that there's really, our spirit, our soul is connected to the fiber of the universe. And I definitely think that when you tap into that, whether you get there through meditation or a near-death experience, there's something there that can't be explained by our mere mortal understanding. So, you know, I hope that my answer is the right one, but I believe that there's something bigger than us always, and that gets me through a lot of tough times as well.
I'm glad to hear it, because it shows me that you and I are cut far apart. Yeah, I certainly believe that we are part of the warp and woof, the web of creation. It's kind of like, I don't know, we're like a drop in an ocean, and we're part of everything. It motivates me, and it's given me a strong moral sense as well. In the sense that my morality, my ethics all flow from that. If even my enemies, and my political enemies or whatever, are part of me, how can I be evil toward them? I can't. They're part of me. And so it's given me a whole new sense in terms of the negotiating I do. And I've done a lot of it. I did a lot of negotiations after leaving the Foreign Service. I helped end a war in Cambodia. I was active in the Middle East for years. I had a small part to play in creating the original Oslo Accords between Israel and Palestine. And I helped solve a crisis, an environmental crisis in the Everglades. And my standing, my spirituality has been a real bulwark for me in dealing with contesting forces and even people doing bad stuff. And so it motivates me a lot, and it still motivates me. And you know, it's the basis for what I do, because I'm convinced that there's no more powerful motivation for any of us than that our lives be meaningful, that we find personal meaning to our lives. I thought I'd found that meaning in adrenaline rushes, and a lot of my buddies and friends today think they found it in, you know, money and power, and we're all damn wrong. I found from 83 years that the most stable source of meaning in anybody's life is some kind of service. And I'm not talking about sackcloth and ashes. I'm not talking about any of us becoming Mother Teresa. No, I'm talking about leading ordinary lives, but doing so with an eye that what's important in your life is not maximizing third quarter earnings. What's important in your life is doing something that's meaningful, taking stock of the skills and resources that you have and context that you have. And then doing something that helps move the ball forward, that helps solve significant public problems. And I do a lot of lecturing I did before COVID, to business audiences. And I tell hard-bitten business people, whether it's in a C-suite or an auditorium full of people at an annual meeting, that what's important is to find that meeting. And you can find that meeting in service through a business. Make a good product, sell it for a fair price under fair labor conditions, with a decent respect for the environment, and as a good neighbor for the communities in which you operate. Well, hell, that's service. A neurosurgeon has service. A barber can be of service, etc. So I want to make sure your audience understands that I'm not some super liberal namby-pamby. No, I'm a real tough guy, and you want me in the foxhole if that's your situation. But at the same time, I'm saying nothing's more important than to find service in your work. Use your resources and find it. Solve a problem right in front of you, or as my wife Ann says, lift up the corner of the rug you lift.
I like that. That's a good saying. And again, I'm assuming we can read most of this in your book, Quest, which is Risk, Adventure, and the Search for Meaning. Now an audiobook, by the way. But you've also put out other writings. You've had the Denali Diary, which is, you know, highlighting your mountaineering trip in North America, formerly known as Mount McKinley. Also, Stick Your Neck Out, A Street Smart Guide to Change, which I'm assuming is going to have to do quite a bit with your Giraffe Heroes project, and then an outdoor leadership piece of work as well. So, and then you're also doing a blog. Am I correct on that?
You said I have a commentary. Mostly political issues. Most recently, it's been, of course, on issues like Ukraine and the Middle East. I have a blog. The Denali Diary is the last book I've done. That was a labor of love. I found an old diary from that time. I don't know where I left it. It was a diary. So I created a picture book, if you will, using some great photographs and my own words as a climber on that 38-day incredibly dangerous climb. And it was a labor of love putting it together. Denali Diary, by the way, is a free download. Oh, yeah, my website is John Graham, my name, .org. And if you go to the nav bar, you'll see Denali Diary, or you go to the homepage, you'll see a link to Denali Diary, and you can download it and read it for free. I may put up a paywall sooner or later, but I just did it, so it's free for now.
Yeah, so there you go. Check it out. Make sure to get a copy of that for free for now, so don't drag your feet on that. Well, John, if you could give my listeners a couple pieces of advice, what would you tell people, the most important couple of things that you have learned over your years of not only service, but adventure?
Well, I tell you, I've already said it, but I mean, the most important thing, I think, for anyone it is to find the personal meaning for your life. And if you haven't found it, or if you found you found something that's not satisfying you, then keep looking, because nothing's more important. And when they put you in a pine box, you want to know you've done something. Or more accurately, when you look at the mirror in the morning, you want to know that what's looking back at you matters, that you're not on the planet just to mark time, that you're here for a purpose. And that to be on Earth without a purpose is like being a fine Swiss watch with no hands on it. There's a purpose for your life, and you need to find it. And I'm saying, with my experience, not just my own experience, but the thousands of people that the Giraffe Project has honored, people who found real purpose for their life have found it in some kind of service again, not Mother Teresa, but finding service right where you are. Look around you. There are problems, problems that concern you. Well, get out there and make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely love that. And if you'd like to learn more about John, check his personal site out, johngraham.com. Obviously, head over to giraffe.org. There you can learn about all the great things they're doing with the organization, ways that you can get involved and get your hands on some of the material. And again, like John said, find a purpose for your life, find meaning, something that gives you fulfillment. But also, I wholeheartedly agree, and that's really what this podcast is about. It's helping people learn and grow. And so find a way to serve and give to your community and to people around you that maybe can't do it themselves. So be the voice for somebody and use your platform like John did, not only with his intelligence and experience in foreign relations, but then he turned that into the ability to understand how to communicate with people. So find your strengths and go out there and give them to the world.
Joe, you said johngraham.com. It's johngraham.org, O-R-G.
O-R-G, I apologize. So I'll make sure to put the correct link at the bottom of this video when this is released. So johngraham.org and giraffe.org. So
yeah,
again, when we lost you earlier, I spelled it and I did it wrong. You're right. That is a particularly hard word to spell when you're doing it on the spot.
Perfect. Hey, I'm really enjoying this show and I'm really enjoying you. Thank you for doing this podcast.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time, John. I look forward to continuing our friendship and our partnership moving forward. Would love to have you back on for a follow-up and let's push out the Giraffe Heroes Project. Remember, guys, it's all about sticking your neck out for others, and you can find more information at giraffe.org. So I want to thank you, John, for your time today, and I look forward to talking to you soon, sir.
I do too, Joe. Thank you so much.